So what I'll do is give a quick, I should first say I don't, oh, did I have, oh good, no disclosures, no relationships to disclose. So what I'd like to do is just give a brief historical context for immigration detention. I think that you all are probably pretty familiar with this growing institution in our country. Talk a little bit about practices and then discuss some of the medical consequences that we've found, some of the issues for immigrant detainees. So I had this slide in my last talk, but what I wanted to point out is just a couple of changes throughout the last 20 years that have impacted the detention of immigrants. So the HIV travel ban, people have probably heard about. It was a very strange product of some rampant xenophobia that led to the U.S. placing a ban on people with HIV coming into the United States. A visa system was created so that people could leave the country, get a one-year exemption, come back. Oh, yeah. So the HIV travel ban has come to an end, or is about to come to an end, because the federal rulemaking process is almost at a completion. 1996, ARERA, which is a change to immigration laws that pushed us to basically detain more than we didn't detain. So that really swung the needle towards the impetus to detain immigrants who are out of status. And then the Department of Homeland Security was created in 2002, so the INS became ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. So just a couple of overview items. It's a large system, over 400,000 a year. Immigrations and Customs Enforcement, ICE, is the detaining authority, so these aren't folks who are detained for criminal reasons. Many, many different detention settings, jails, prisons, private detention centers, and this is there's a lot of money going into the system, so there's a lot of money coming out of it. That is to say, the government pays a lot of money to detain all these folks, and somebody reaps the reward or profits from that. And it's not just private detention centers, it's many county jails, a multitude of, as diverse as you can find in the corrections world. So these are pretty self-explanatory, these slides. This is Detention Watch Network, has a very good map of where the detention centers are. This I showed in my last talk. This is the Elizabeth Detention Center, which is a food warehouse converted to a people warehouse. This is kind of a schematic showing that detained immigrants find themselves to the left. There is all of the facilities, these ISGA contracts. So they could be in a county jail, some other like facility that's not run by ICE. On the right, they may be part of a facility that's administered by Homeland Security itself. And over on the far right, I want to point out the Division of Immigrant Health Services. So this is an office that used to be part of HHS, and then in 2002, with the creation of Homeland Security, was taken out of HHS and put into the Homeland Security Department. So the problems we and others have found, I should say others far before us, because I apologize for repeating this from the earlier talk, but as physicians, we often come a little bit late to the fight when it comes to advocacy issues, but so people in the advocacy community had been for years talking about the lack of legal protections, the lack of guaranteed medical care, also problems with transparency and reporting problems when they're found, and then I'll just talk for a minute about the health plan and medical standards for detainees. So this is, I don't want to make this too complicated, but you see up there, I've got health plan and medical standard. So what does that mean? Well, immigrants who are detained, when they're in the detention center, there's a series of detention standards. So these are everything from phones to toilets to what kind of housing area, and one of those detention standards is a medical care standard. So that's the medical standard. That is an area where Homeland Security, in coordination with the ICE NGO working group, groups of advocates, I think there's been, some significant headway made. There's certainly room to improve, but that governs like what kind of medical clinic do you have, and when do you have sick call, and what are the medical care functions that happen in a detention center. Now there's something called a health plan. I'm not going to give you the full name, but it governs reimbursement for care outside the detention center. So if you are sick in the detention center, but not so sick that you need to go out 911, for the detention center doc to send you to a clinic or a hospital somewhere in the community, they have to take a look at if they want to get reimbursed for that care, because that care isn't automatically covered as part of the contract. They have to get prior approval, and the set of rules that govern that is called the, I'm going to call it the health plan. It's called the Detainee Medical Dental Services Package. So that health plan is grossly insufficient and has been the object of criticism by us in the medical community and by people in the advocacy community. And my hope is, and I think we may hear a little bit about this today, that just like we've worked on increasing the medical standards sufficiency, that this health plan, which as it currently stands is grossly insufficient, may also be under review and hopefully improvement. So this health plan that I just said those bad things about. So first of all, this is the introduction. So when you pick up this health plan and you read it, what does it say? Healthcare is limited to healthcare services for emergency care, and then it says what emergency care is. So just a couple of cases. This case I just mentioned before, so I'll make it very brief, but a gentleman comes into a detention center, has a bleeding penile lesion. The detention center doctors realize that he may have cancer. They send him to a cancer specialist. So they get him through the health plan once, right? They get him through to see a specialist on the outside. But then when that specialist says he needs a biopsy, when they go to get prior approval for the biopsy, it comes back that the biopsy's been labeled an elective procedure. And long story short, this is a gentleman who unfortunately died of metastatic penile cancer many, many months later. So, ethics. This is also part of the current iteration of the detainee health plan. And basically, if you look at the bold there, it says, we started off by hearing the scope, right? It's just emergency care. But then it goes on to say, you can do some things besides just emergency care. So it says, you can treat conditions which, if left untreated during the period of custody, would cause deterioration of the detainee's health or suffering affecting his deportation status. So what that means is that we're asking clinicians to estimate length of detention and make a judgment about whether or not failure to treat would affect deportation status. So this is a kind of language that doesn't exist, for instance, with the Marshals Program, doesn't exist in any other correctional standards that I've ever come across. Screening. So screening, I think this is maybe the most, it's very problematic. So everybody who's had one semester of biostatistics or epidemiology or public health can look at this and tell me what's wrong with it, which is that we start off saying this is how we screen for disease, but then we say, well, it's on a case-by-case basis, and it's subject to clinical findings. So then it's not screening, right? So you've, like, used the word screening. You've cloaked yourself in the warm, fuzzy feeling of healthcare screening, but what you've done is said we're not going to really screen. What we're going to do is we're going to diagnose. That's a diagnostic test. So the things that we have advocated, and many besides us, I don't ever want to propose to you that as, you know, physicians or as people from NYU, we are the first to either find these problems or suggest these solutions, but I think that we are trying to bring our voices to this and help in constructive ways to improve. So the first is we have advocated for not just improving the health plan. That health plan that I showed you those snippets of, I think is grossly insufficient, needs to be improved, but also to link that to some enforcement action so that we could improve that health plan as, you know, to be fantastic, something that we all agreed on. But if it's not linked to some ability to either issue fines or issue damages or somehow, you know, some teeth that really make it enforceable, I think it's the improvements will be largely in vain. Secondly, we'd like to have ICE and DHS reporting out not just mortality but also morbidity, because death is a rare occurrence in the ICE system. You know, people are detained for 30, 40, 50 days. So just like in a jail system, mortality is rare, morbidity is common. So reporting should involve morbidity. So how often do your hemoglobin A1Cs under diabetics get worse, right? How often do your LTBI folks, your tuberculosis people with non-pulmonary TB, how often do they get treatment? How often do people miss a surgery or miss a chemotherapy? Standard morbidity measures should be reported. The third thing is, I think something we all agree on is that healthcare should be guaranteed as a matter of law, just like it is for prisoners. There's legislation underway And I'll have another talk about the legal aspects of this tomorrow. And then I think the final thing is put fewer people into detention. I think that this is a system right now that's delivering inadequate care at the rate of 400,000 people a year. So my guess is if next year we detain 415,000 people, the care is going to get worse. And in spite of, I think, some very constructive efforts by ICE and DHS to improve medical care, the bottom line is if you have a system that isn't fixed yet, and then you push more people into it, the end result is predictable. I'd like to thank Alan, who's here, and everybody else. And what we can do is move on to Megan.